Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books Network. I am Eralda Lameborshi, your host for this episode. And today I am speaking with my dear friend and brilliant academic, Marta Pushan Oliva, whose book, Narrative Reliability, Racial Conflicts, and Ideology in the Modern Novel, was published by Routledge in their Literary Criticism and Cultural Theory series. Marta is Ramon y Cajal Senior Researcher at the University of the Balearian Islands in Spain. She has worked at the University of Pompeu Fabra, Harvard University, the Universitat de Barcelona, and the Universitat Oberta de Catalunya. Marta has conducted research periods at New York University, Princeton University, the University of Chicago, and Harvard University. This last one was a Marie Sklodowska-Curie outgoing fellowship from the European Commission. She is a specialist in comparative literature, especially in the fields of narrative theory, comparative racial studies, eco-criticism, and global literary studies. She has published various articles on these topics in journals like Poetics Today, Studies in the Novel, English Studies, Lettral, Journal of Global History, and the Journal of World Literature. Her book, as I mentioned earlier, Narrative Reliability, Racial Conflicts, and Ideology in the Modern Novel, published by Routledge, bridges narrative theory with a constitution of racial ideologies. Currently, she works on the global novel in the I+D project, co-directed with Neus Rutsche, the novel as a global platform, poetic challenges, and cross-border circulation. For the last few years, she has been working on global environments in literature, especially the ocean, studying environmental criminality at sea in contemporary literary and film narratives. She is a member of the research group Contemporary Literature, Comparative Studies, and Theory. It is such a pleasure to be able to talk with you, Marta, and thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Thank you, Eralda, for giving me the opportunity to talk about it and for your generous reading.
So I wanted to start by asking about the story or the origin of the book. What was the initial idea that transformed to the book we now hold? How did that seed of an idea develop into this finished project?
So I got very interested about the narrative technique of unreliability by reading Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom. And I was very focused on language and form. I was studying that in my master thesis in Spain. And it was only when I started investigating about it, that I realized that I was never taught about the racial context in the US that was contemporary to Faulkner. And then when I started reading his nonfiction texts and essays, I realized that all that he was talking about was about the racial context. So I realized that even if for me it seemed that form and unreliability was the most important part of the book,
right,
it really wasn't. So and then I started asking myself why that was so, and how where these two important elements connected. So I decided to write a dissertation on that book and a parallel phenomenon that I could see happening in Conrad's Lord Jim. And then I started detecting that, in fact, narrative reliability was being used in several contemporary novels to this cause complicated ideological conflicts, and in that case, racial ones. And then that's how I ended up writing a dissertation on Conrad's Lord Jim and Faulkner's Absalom Absalom, but thinking about a number of novels that were doing so, which I finally ended up developing in my post-dissertation project, which was this book.
Right. So it's a long, long journey to get here. And I'm just really glad that the book is here. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And it creates some really important interventions in narrative theory, but also, you know, talking about the historical underpinnings of the racial politics in the literature. And so I wanted to start with talking mainly about the theoretical framework that you build here in the book, and ask a question about some of the remarks that you make in the introduction, which is really wonderful to ground the reader in those theoretical foundations of the book and how those theories inform your analysis in the case studies. And I was specifically looking at this one passage, which I will read because I don't think that my paraphrasing would be better phrased than what you did here in the book. But you write that this book focuses on the intertwined relationship between narrative reliability and racial conflicts and ideologies. It argues that the problem of reliability in narrative fiction often makes use of the problem of reliability in historical discourse, and that we need to examine a work of fiction's historical context in order to comprehend technical modulations of narrative reliability. Can you speak a little more on the idea of enactment of racial conflict that shows elsewhere in the introduction as a tool to experiment with narrative reliability? And maybe, you know, you can also illustrate this with examples from the novels that you analyze in the book.
Sure. I think that when we are focusing on narrative reliability and especially unreliability, which is the technique that has been more studied, we forget that this is a rhetorical technique that is happening elsewhere, everywhere, and that in fact any political discourse is relying on that axis of credibility or that principle of credibility. And therefore, when we look at ideologies, and especially like racial ideologies, which are clearly constructing a specific view, which many times very unstable basis, this issue of credibility is very, very at the core of those ideologies, right? And for example, I will give a brief example, but for example, the idea of the mulatto, for example, that is a figure that appears in the census in the United States, but all of a sudden is abolished from the census in 1920. And a whole ideological construct is buttressing the need or and existence of a mulatto prior to 1920 And after that, because there are mulattoes will be assimilated into this black race in the division between white and black races in the segregation, established by the segregation, then the idea of the mulatto all of a sudden disappears. It doesn't disappear, of course, but it legally disappears. And therefore, this is an example of how you will have a discourse, a political and legal and social discourse that is going to be constructed in one way or another, appealing to a credibility that all of a sudden changes because the census changes. So that is an example of how you need to provide a special reliability in politics. And this appears, for example, especially in Absalom Absalom, but also in James Weldon Johnson, the autobiography of an ex-colored man, which is another of my examples.
Thank you. That really clarifies a lot. And I think the example of the mulatto that you provided is such an apt one to illustrate your idea of, and I really like this phrase that you mentioned, the excess of credibility or principle of credibility. Well, and we'll continue to talk about it as I sort of go through some of the other questions. So I found your discussion on historicizing narrative theory very compelling, especially as it intervenes in the more dominant posture of conflating historiography and fiction. And so I was wondering if you could speak a little more at length on why you think that this intervention is necessary. And I think this connects to your previous answer, of course, and what is responding to. And I think the example that you just provided perhaps responds to that or to this question. But more importantly, I was wondering if you can discuss your approach as one that's closer to Marxist postcolonial and cultural perspectives on literature.
Yeah, sure. I think that you're right to think that the idea of historicizing narrative theory is something that is coming out lately in the field of narratology through especially the work of authors like Rita Olson or Sarah Copland, for example, or Stefan Iversen, who are working with the idea that you cannot divorce politics and history from narrative strategies, no matter how much you want to focus on language, because finally, language is not separable from meaning, and language is used for providing meaning. So part of the problem of narratology as a field has been historically that it's become very abstract and very against, I would say, in many occasions, against history or neglecting history. And by history, I mean like history in a broad sense, including also, of course, all kinds of cultural studies or political perspectives or economic perspectives or any kind of ideological perspectives, right? I think that is, of course, as you say, a perspective that very much comes from Marxist, as you say, and postcolonial studies. In many ways, I've always felt closer to Marxist studies rather than postcolonial, even if postcolonial studies have shaped many of my perspectives. But what I mean by this is that what I've tried to do in this book and what I mean by historicizing narrative theory is focusing and investigating context. So not staying at the discourse level, which is very interesting, very important to understand how language works and how ideologies work, but also you need to understand what is the context in which ideologies operate. And therefore, to follow my earlier example, it's the idea of the mulatto in the United States, for example, in the 1920s, has nothing to do with the idea of the half-caste in the British Empire in the late 19th century. So why? Because the stereotype has been built in a special way that it helps perform certain political actions. And therefore, that really makes the context relevant. Every racial conflict that I study in this book is using certain stereotypes that have been seen from sometimes post-colonial studies or books that stay at the abstract level as some stereotypes that work more similarly than they do in their actual context and than they do in the specific novels. And so when I mean historicizing, I mean really looking, and it's a lot of effort in that sense, but looking at what happens in that historical context and how that stereotype is being used at a certain moment, right? And I think that's what we need, even if it's a lot of effort. It's part of what makes sense of the ideologies and makes us understand how the ideologies are operating for every case.
Yeah. So since we are on this idea of stereotype, you stated that stereotype performs political actions, which I really love that formulation. And your discussion on the notion of stereotype in the book itself, where you invoke Toni Morrison, where she states that stereotypes are a form of narrative economy. It ties so beautifully with, you know, this idea of excess of credibility, stereotypes as credible signs or constructions or constructs that tell a story by virtue of the narrative that they provide here. And so could you extend a little bit your discussion, which you just started on, you know, this idea of stereotypes and how they figure in your work theoretically, but also in terms of how they show up and shape narratives in the novels that you have selected to discuss in the book?
Sure. I think that it is very, the idea of the stereotype as a form that it's not in fact fixed or like an image, but it's something that is the build that tells a story, is what Toni Morrison means by saying that the stereotypes are a form of economy in technical terms, because you introduce into the narrative the stereotype, and then you don't need to say a lot of things that are presumed by the legacy or the way in which that stereotype has been constructed. So then that helps the narrative to move forward in a certain way, or it helps this kind of narratives that I'm looking at, which are narratives that include a lot of gaps, a lot of enigmas, a lot of uncertainties, to fill those gaps. And we can talk about this later. But what the stereotype is doing is guiding the narrative towards a certain point, thanks to the ways in which that stereotype in that specific racial conflict at the moment in which at least the book is being produced, is asking the reader to fill in so that to fill those gaps. And I think in that sense, we haven't looked enough the ways, the narratives that every specific stereotype is telling for each of the novels we're looking at. And I think that is a very interesting exercise that shows how stereotypes are finally narrative forms and how they are perpetuating in a way by making those assumptions and feeling those silences, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I also wonder too, you know, because as you say that stereotypes are narratives and they are not fixed, right? That they are shifting and changing, and they are getting and they reflect perhaps shifts, cultural shifts as well. I also wonder if the nature, sort of this protean nature of the narratives, also mirrors the narratives with gaps and enigmas, in the sense that if, for instance, we had a stereotype, let's say 3 decades ago, that now doesn't necessarily apply or doesn't necessarily hold the same story that it might have 3 decades ago, that in some ways it might be considered to be non-threatening or non or as it doesn't contribute anything discursively to the current moment. It seems to me that part of what you're arguing is that regardless of what the narrative of a stereotype is right now, it's important to actually link it to the narrative that it held in that specific historical context where it was birthed.
Yes, totally so. Mm-hmm. And I can provide here one of the examples I found with that, which is the case of the English gentleman in Conrad's lordship. This stereotype is especially interesting in the way you're pointing out. First, for two reasons. First, because it's not a stereotype that has perpetuated to our present moment in a clear way. And second, because since this a whiteness stereotype, which of course, like studies of whiteness have helped me, like starting with Toni Morrison, have helped us very much to identify stereotypes that we don't feel they are stereotypes, but they are stereotypes as well. The English gentleman is a white man stereotype, that it's purposely being constructed, especially during the 19th century, but with a lot of particularities after the 1870s, when there is sort of a view that the British Empire needs more what they called colonial officers to be sent to this increasing and very spread out empire and with a lot of colonial outposts, especially in Asia. And they needed people who would follow instructions and who would sort of understand very well what was their figure and their function and what they were representing in because they were sending a small number of people to each post. And therefore, the model, the informal imperialist model of the British, needed very strong, not personalities, but very fitting personalities that would hold the empire together. And therefore, they created this stereotype of the English gentleman with all these attributes that were even part of the exams that they had to pass, which were very morally structured. And therefore, when we read Lord Jim today, even if the stereotype is there, and the criticism and the uncertainty of how much of this character that is called Jim, that is central in the novel, is or is not fitting to the stereotype of the English gentleman for which he has been instructed and committed to perform, it's the whole question of the book and how much the ways in which the empire is projecting itself through this English gentleman fits with the reality of the empire and what happens in the specific Malayan context here for this novel. So now when we read this novel, because the imperial English gentleman is not there anymore as a ideological need, we probably miss it as part of what drives the narrative in such a strong way. This does not mean that we cannot read this book now. Of course we can. But all that narrative that was being questioned and interrogated, it's partly lost for us now if we don't go back to the historical context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also sense that there is an analysis of scale here, right? We do have the more large scale post-colonial analysis that we have on empire, et cetera. But it seems to me that, especially in relation to Conrad's Lord Jim, that your analysis sort of burrows into this very specific, and I say small scale, or probably the better word would be more a cellular almost analysis of this one specific construction of the English gentleman and how that discursively represents the empire, which I think, it's really effective, I feel, especially in terms of its connection to the idea of narrative reliability, which you reframe as the problem of narrative reliability. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more on this specific reframe and where you analyze reliability as a principle of narrative discourse.
I think what happens here, at least in the field of narratology, is that narrative unreliability has been very finely discussed and since the late 1990s, and a very so technically in a very detailed way. And I think that is fascinating. But what the problem that I found, and this is probably the most important contribution of this book, at least from my point of view, is the fact that because there are many voices, let's say, that do not fit a clear unreliability, we have left them out of the discussion of how they build, I would say, like distrust in the novel. So, or problematize the credibility in the novel. So all the cases that I review here, which are Faulkner's Absalom, Conrad's Lord Jim, James Weldon Johnson's The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, Albert Camus, L'Étranger, and Alejo Carpentier, El Reino de Este Mundo, The Kingdom of This World, all these novels would not fit into any discussion of unreliability. However, you could argue that they have unreliable voices. And that happens because they stand in uncertainty. They stand in ambivalence. They are credible to a certain point. They are dubious or questionable to a great extent. So because they don't pronounce themselves as clearly unreliable, we haven't discussed them in terms of how they build or interrogate reliability. So from that reflection, I started thinking that we had not got into the core of the problem, which was not reliable or unreliable, but was specifically the problem of how you built credibility, which might mean that to build distrust or to build trust, but it's a problem. The problem is how you build this reliability and how you built in that problem of reliability, how you interrogate it. Because this is something that doesn't have to mean it's true or not true. It's not a question of true or false. It's a question of how much you get your reader or your listener, not only in fiction, to believe you. It's a question of belief. It's a question of trust. And therefore, we haven't examined that as a problem and a principle in fiction. I think that reliability is a principle in any kind of narrative, fictional and non-fictional, that we haven't addressed as such. And that because we have only studied this division, we have left many of these interesting novels that explore how we create this reliability and how we deal with the problem of this reliability in discourse. And that's how we reframe this as the problem of narrative reliability, not meaning reliability as something you feel it's credible, but as a principle that can be modulated in many, many, many different ways.
I was wondering, just as a follow-up to your discussion just now on the problem of reliability, which I think it's such a important reframe of, and especially as it seeks to, or whether it seeks to or not is irrelevant, but rather the effect is such that, you know, these reliability and unreliability as pitted against one another is not so much the issue. It's how we determine or how we build that trust with the reader, or the novels rather, build the trust with the reader, which I think is a very different question. That's really important, especially in connection to your third chapter, which is the one on William Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom, entitled Degrees of Reliability, Miscegenation, and the New South Creed in William Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom. And so you locate the historical conflict, you isolate the purposes of your analysis and what racial discourses emerge there. And so if you could illustrate with this particular chapter, you know, the problem of reliability, which you just explained.
Yes, it's what I meant by degrees of reliability meant that this is a polyphonic novel. It has several narrators, and all of them have their point of view on the same story. And they're telling and piecing it out together, including many contradictions between the versions in a situation that you can imagine for yourself in many other occasions, right, as happening around you. So you would have, for example, Rosa, which is a narrator who is a widow of the Civil War, and she is very invested in the New South Creed and the idea that we lost the war and that the plantation moment and the pre-Civil War period was much better than it is now, of course, has a view over the story that is completely different than, for example, Shreve, who is a Canadian who is talking to Quentin and who doesn't care much about the Southern context, but he just wants the story told in a manner that is logical and coherent. And so the ways in which you might trust Rosa for what she has experienced and she knows, it's not exactly the same of how you would trust Shreve, who initially is very enthusiastic about the story and is a great teller. So you engage with his story, and he also provides a solution to the enigma of why one character killed the other, why Quentin killed, one character, Henry, killed Bond. But what happens is that Shreve invents parts of the story that you as a reader are not sure that is how it happened, and you don't know how he got, you know, the information from. So in a way, this creates sort of a myriad of characters who none of them could be fully reliable, if you want. Many people who talk about, who don't like the idea that there are unreliable narrations, criticize the fact that, well, all narrators are unreliable. And to a certain extent, that is true. So what, again, the importance here is not to classify whether Rosa is an unreliable narrator or not. It's to detect in what moments in the narrative and for what purposes and for what reasons and how there are introducing aspects that what they do is create a distance between the reader and the tale as it is being narrated. And that's how I see sometimes this principle of reliability functioning as sort of modulating distance that keeps changing between the reader and the narrative, right? With extreme moments in which you would say, well, Shreve does say this character is black, but he has no information about this. We know there's no information about this. So at that moment, you would say, whew, you would create an absolute distance and feel that it's being an unreliable narration. But on the other, at other moments, you would feel, yes, he's following this and this and that, and we know all he's saying. So you will feel closer. You will feel more bonding reliability, as Fallon would say, right? So I feel this works across the different narratives as that certain movement between reader and narration, creating a constant tension. Because you never know exactly if what you're being told is certain or uncertain.
Right. And just to follow up on that, like when this narrative trust, there's this break, right? Or the instability of belief or trust that the reader experiences as a result of these different manners of narrative delivery from the various characters, especially in Epsilon. When the trust breaks, what would you say the implications of that are? Not only in terms of highlighting more formally the idea of the problem of reliability, but beyond that, what would you say the implications would be?
I think in many ways, politically, the implications mm-hmm. are huge.
Right.
And that's probably the purpose of this book,
right.
to show that in a way, this moment of breaking of the truth, and this happens, for example, in Alejo Carpentier's El Reino de Este Mundo, there is a crucial moment in which you have had the history or the experience of the Haitian Revolution from the point of view of a slave. And at a moment in which he is being burnt, you have two narratives. And you have been trusting the narrative that believes in the perspective of the voodoo. And all of a sudden, you're forced to change because you get the perspective of the French colonials who just see the body burning while the slaves see the body sort of flowing away, right? Flying away. So at that moment, the reader sort of breaks with the sort of ideological commitment or subscription that she or he has been following till that point, right? If you believe Shreve's story, then you are assuming a racial ideology. At the moment in which you separate yourself from that, you are politically, in that case, breaking your commitment and adscription or assumption of that ideology, which at many points and for most of these novels is a desolating situation because there is no alternative. And that's one of the incredible things that these novels do, right? You are deciding that you don't believe my narrator, then you have to assume that you don't have a response to how this story ends. You don't have a response to what really happened because you don't believe me. So in that sense, I think it's interesting because in many ways, when you do this in our situation, the pandemic, for example, has also many times created this feeling that you don't believe to a certain point all that is being said. And that you're feeling, you know, how in a way, for example, all the pharmaceutical or medical industry is sort of, you know, making profit out of this. And in a way, you want to distance yourself, but you don't have an alternative. And that is the exact point, which is a very uncomfortable point that all these novels put you in, right? Because the novels all, in a way, compel you to believe in a way that is kind of complicit with racial ideologies, as you might expect from, in different, very different degrees, in very different ways, from many of these writers. So it's the same point of uncertainty and feeling uncomfortable when you don't align.
And, you know, I asked about the implications because, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's very clear that there's some important political implications here, and especially in a milieu where we do have a lot of misinformation and a lot of political discourse that misleads and creates a lot of doubt in the electorate all over the world. But I think your example of the pandemic is especially a poignant one, in the sense that it estranges people from their medical providers. It estranges them from their political representatives. You know, this idea of separating oneself or not fully buying into whatever story that is being provided. And so that sort of, for me, is a nice segue in talking a little bit about your fourth chapter, especially with this idea of estrangement and distancing, like this dissonance in the narrative itself, where you address from the start the problem of narration with a narrative voice in the novel. It's a very puzzling book, of course. And you write this, you state that the narrator uses this estranging narrative or underreporting as an ideological strategy common in colonial discourse, which then suggests that the narrative can be read as discordant itself. And you follow this up with this brief statement requires some disentangling. And so if you can do a brief disentangling of that particular statement about about Camus' Stranger in relation to everything that we've talked about so far.
Yes, in this chapter on Albert Camus L'Étranger, I thought it is very interesting because an unreliability many times is not in the problem of reliability. It's mostly many times building not only what you say, but on what you don't say, or in what you say that is covering or has implications that are not directly said, but are implicit. And I will explain this in a second. But what happens in L'Étranger is that you have a narrator that underreports, doesn't say much, doesn't express much. And then you might assume that as part of the way he narrates, but this keeps accumulating in a way that you feel that the narration is neglecting several things. And this happens when you learn and when in the trial, the issue or the fact that Merceau, the narrator, has killed an Arab comes to the surface in a way in which the narrator hasn't even mentioned almost. And then in a way, the whole question of what are the racial implications there? Not only racial and politically speaking, always. I always talk about race, not that much in terms of political or of identity politics, but more on the ways in which race has been mobilized, in this case, for imperial matters. So part of the strategy that Merceau uses is a sort of an a covert strategy, in the sense that what Camille did and invested a lot of time doing this is in constructing a discourse of what was called la Méditerranée, of the Mediterranean. And what this discourse that seems very enthusiastic about how different people in the different cultures in the Mediterranean are, and how, you know, they are devoted to pleasure, they have a special sensitivity, they have a common root, etc. In fact, this was used in colonial Algeria in the 1930s, and especially by the School of Alger, a group of writers, to sort of buttress an ideological argument, which was a French colonial argument, that meant that Algeria had been originally sort of a Latin country, and therefore that was where all the cultural Mediterranean values were coming. And then only later Arabs came into the country and occupied it. And therefore, in a way, the French colonial occupation was part of, you know, a recovery of the old values that we had. So in a certain way, the way in which Arabs were treated by the colonial Algeria, in which they were asked to be naturalized and sort of leave their Muslim religion aside, was part to became to become pure Algerians in a way, was built or reinforced by all this discourse of the Mediterranean, which you can find in all L'Étranger. If you remember L'Étranger, he's all the time swimming and talking about, you know, the beaches and all that, in a way that really it underreports all the implications that this discourse had for organizing racially who was the real Algerian and who not. But it's what is being said in the novel, and that you don't realize if you don't know about it in a certain way. Because the Arabs as such are never addressed or object of interest or subjects of interest by the narrator. And that's how you see underreporting, because the whole problem between Arabite and Algerite is never there, but it's developed implicitly through the discourse of the Mediterranean.
That's really remarkable, actually, as an analysis. It's very inspiring, Marta. I really love your book. And so I wanted to, and, you know, I don't want to take too much of your time, but I wanted to address a little bit on some points on chapter 2, which is an analysis on James Weldon Johnson's The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. And you locate reliability at the threshold of narrative. And you link paratext, genre, and narrative in your analysis there, you know, where, you know, the text itself, given its origins and how it was anonymously published, it was a political act in a sense, but then there's this threat that you locate, the threat of passing for white. Could you speak a little more on how the chapter views textual location of reliability and how it reinforces its dependence on historical context?
Yes, I think this is a fascinating book because it has a history, publication history, that makes you think about the idea of the versions and the idea of where to locate reliability. And so the first version of The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man was published in 1912 as anonymously. And then the title itself, The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, being this a story in the first person voice, talking about how this person is now passing for white, it's a story that could be easily be taken as true. Because in a way, the editors in the preface also invited that reading. And therefore, you could easily think, well, who is that person who is whose identity is not revealed because this is anonymous and he's telling his own story? It reflects very much the context in which there were many autobiographies that we're doing in texts that were nonfiction texts, like the slave narratives that were circulating as well, as part of this tradition that of African-American literature of telling your own story in the first person and then giving giving account of what was happening with African-American discrimination and the idea of passing as being a menace as seen in the moment of publication. But then in the second edition, what happened is that James Weldon Johnson was became a very acclaimed author in the Harlem Renaissance, and he was taken as a literary model as well for the development of African-American culture in ways in which the Harlem Renaissance, as you know, reaffirmed very much and explored very much African-American culture and sort of vindicated it as part of, re-vindicated it as part of a full identity that was developing its own literature. So the second publication in 1927 included the idea that this was a novel, so it declared a genre of the novel, so it was fictionalized in a certain way, and therefore you would have the fact that becoming a novel, you first would locate the narrative voice in the text, which is also unreliable or it's questionable in terms of unreliability, you will locate that in the realm of fiction and not that much as an autobiography in the threshold between what is fiction and what is not fiction. And so in a way, the problem, which is a social problem of passing, gets, you know, sort of taken into back into the fiction, which is a much more a much less menacing space than that of a text that is non-fiction, right? And so I think the paratext in that sense, the fact that the first was anonymously published and could be interpreted as somebody who was really passing and therefore placing a racial threat into the white readers, which is an action that is being removed later, is something that I think interrogates where you place reliability in relation to, or the problem of reliability in relation to the readers and the social context in which it's being published and read.
Right. And again, I'm really enjoying our conversation, but I don't. I know you're busy and you have a lot of projects going on. And speaking about those, you indicate in your bio that you are working on literature on global environments and especially the ocean. And if you could tell us a little bit more on this work and future projects as they connect to our conversation today, or even if they don't connect to our conversation.
They really connect even if it's not apparent. They're right. Always connected. Right? But I can tell how they connect. And it's interesting. So I'm working now on global ideologies. So thinking again about how we construct ideologies through discourse and through narratives. And in this case, I've been investigating for the past few years how we have built global discourses, and especially related to spaces that we consider global. And in that sense, I'm especially focusing on the sea and narratives of the sea, which convey the idea that, or make us believe historically, that the sea is a global space, is a common space for everybody and is shared, and that it needs to be globally managed and internationally managed, and that it we need to share it, and that it's separate in a way from the political, or escapes the political bound national boundaries, because it's internationally managed. So thinking about that ideology, I started thinking about the ocean as a space, because through Melville's Benito Cereno and another Juan Benet's Suprosa, which is a short story by a Spanish writer, in which they use unreliability, or they interrogate reliability, to say it better. Because at sea, many things happen that are lost because people don't survive, because like the slaves that were thrown overboard, there is a lot of margin to do things that get unregistered and untraced. And therefore, the narratives of the sea many times contain these problems of uncertainty, ambivalence, unreliability. And they, in a way, they contain this interrogation about this space, this special space. And so from there, I started thinking the sea as a special space, and the ideologies that are being constructed about the sea, and how they relate to especially crime. Since from this example of the slave traffic, and so that's how I got into the sea, criminality at sea, and global ideologies that I'm working on now.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I cannot help but think that there is perhaps, like, in that trajectory that there, or in that project, that there might be even space to consider even the migrant literatures, right, where we have people using the sea as this international space, moving from border to border, which border crossing is also criminalized in our militarized borders. And so that would be an interesting, it's a very interesting project that I look forward to learning more and reading about.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I have really enjoyed our conversation, Marta, and thank you so much for being so generous with your time and sharing your work with me and the listeners, whom I thank so much for engaging with these ideas. And again, I'm just thrilled we had this conversation. I think your book is crucial to literary theory and literary studies, and such an important intervention. Thank you again, and I look forward to all your future projects.
Thank you very much, Geralda. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Of course. Thanks. Yes, thank you. Talk soon.